Today's program is brought to you by Nettle Meadow Farm Cheese and Spirits Pairing, taking place on Saturday, June 18th at Nettle Meadow Farm. For more information, visit NettleMeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com.
Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45, 12:50. Have with me today the... Okay, so first of all, Jackie Molecules, thank goodness, is in the booth. We don't have him for that much longer in the booth because he's going to go out, touring on the road there. How you doing, Jack?
I'm good.
You know who we don't have in the studio today? Two people that we don't have in the studio today that we're supposed to have in the studio are Nastasia de Hammer Lopez. Now, Nastasia, her sister graduated from Yale this week.
Congrats.
Congrats. So she was driving back from Connecticut, and the hydraulic clutch in the car she borrowed from her buddy, who lives in New York and has a stick shift.
It's really funny you bring that up, because I'm looking for somebody with a stick shift, because I have to drive stick in Iceland, and I don't know how.
Yeah, well,
I can't find anybody with a stick shift in New York.
You know why?
To prove your point. Yeah, right, exactly.
It gets you off the... When a light turns green, you're always the first one to, you know, if you have to vie with another car for position. If you have a stick shift, even if it's like a VW Bug, you will beat any top-of-the-line sports car with the acceleration from first to second. Boom, you just go very fast.
What about when you're stop and go on the FDR?
Then you get, like, hip problems over many years.
Yeah, anyway, so what I'm saying is, so it burns out, and so she's not here right now. I think she lost hydraulic pressure. It's a hydraulic clutch in the car that she was driving. Anyways, but...
Is she okay?
Yeah, she's fine. Like,
Sounds dangerous.
She didn't get hit. No, she's pulled off to the side of the road.
What was not working? The accelerator, the brake?
No. So so the hydraulic system on the clutch, if there's a leak in the system, it just leaks pressure, and the clutch pedal falls to the floor. Now, ordinarily, you can still kind of get moving. She smelled burning, which at first she thought was the plate actually burning during driving. But you know, after further thinking, we think it's probably the burning oil that was leaking out that she was smelling. But a lot of times with a hydraulic clutch, when it goes, you can get it to run. You just can't use the clutch, but you can get it to run and go. But she wasn't able to get it to go. But here's the good part. So for those of you that know our section of the country, the East Coast, I-95 is the road that runs. It's a flaming sack of crap.
There's usually two or three trucks on fire at any given time.
Yeah, it's often literally a flaming sack of crap, yes. So for those of you that drive like through Connecticut along I-95 or the Merritt, there is a town with a sign that I love. It's Mianus. And Mianus is...
I knew you were going to say this.
Yeah. It's next to Koskob. So you can do like cornhole Mianus jokes constantly. And whenever there's traffic in Mianus, I never, ever fail to say, heavy traffic through Mianus. Like every single time. Even if it's just my dog in the car with me, I say it every time. So literally, her car, she had a breakdown in Mianus.
Oh my God.
What are the chances?
Yeah.
That's good.
She's going to be the butt of a lot of jokes, that's for sure.
Oh, nice. So instead of Nastasia, we have our fearless leader, Patrick Martins, here.
I will be like Nastasia. I will say next to nothing.
Wow.
And make scary faces.
Boom. Now, who we don't have in the studio right now, and I tweeted out twice that he would be here, so hopefully he will arrive. I don't know, Jack, maybe we can try to call him on the telephone and see what's up.
We'll put the search team out for
him. Yeah, put the search team out.
He could be lost in...
Now, Jack, you have a connection to Mr. Leahy through a certain babysitting gig? Is this true?
Well, let's tell the people who it is first. We got Jim Leahy, supposed to be here right now. Jim Leahy is the guy who started Sullivan Street Bakery over 20 years ago now, I think.
Yeah, we have no need for Jim today.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. This is like Pun Central right here going on. But the point is that for those of you that are my age or so, like in your 40s, you can remember what New York was like when the bread here pretty much sucked. I mean, there were people who baked good bread, but like in general, the bread game in New York
It was Wonder Bread in the mid-70s. I mean, the first guy on the Upper East Side, which is a very wealthy neighborhood, was Eli Zabar. He had a place called EAT on 80th and Madison, and that was the first place that really baked, you know, fresh bread, you know, passed a few loaves at a kind of a cookie store or something like that. But yes, you could not find fresh bread, even in New York City back then.
No, I mean, then in the 90s, you had like, I guess when he started, right, the 90s?
No, well, Eli's was, in 80.
Jim. Sullivan Street.
25 years, I think.
Yeah, you know, at the same time, you had like Amy's starting. Remember, Amy's Bread started around the same time on
Sarah
9th
Beth's
Avenue.
Kitchen was the kind of area, but I don't know if they sold loaves to go.
Anyway, Amy's had a wholesale and a retail.
Amy's famous bread was the cornmeal one with raisins in it.
Oh, yeah, I used to get that on Saturday because I used to live right by her bakery. Anyway, point is that back in the day, nowadays, it used to be when you traveled to New York, you're like, hey, it's a great town. Bread sucks. You know what I mean? Seriously, like you would say that. You would expect that the bread you got on the table at a restaurant would suck. You would expect that the bread you would get out at a place, even a cheese shop, you'd expect – I mean, don't even get me started on the cheese shops. You would expect that they would suck, right?
And it was like Tuscany over here.
Well, which is what we're supposed to be talking about today. But so anyway, so Jim Leahy was one of the kind of early – people making decent bread here in New York. And Sullivan Street, I remember, was a revelation when I had it. The first time I went there in the 90s, mid-90s, I guess, I had their Bianca, their Pizza Bianca, and it was the only thing like what I had had over on my honeymoon in Italy. It was good stuff. Anyway, so...
Very crusty bread, right? For the most part.
What,
his breads, yeah, his signature.
Like his signature breads he's known for now are probably like the Pugliese style, the Filoni, which is the huge one, and the Semi di Sesamo, which is the basically Pugliese with sesame seeds all over the outside, which is my personal favorite. So these are the signature breads that you'll see at a lot of restaurants, and there's a, you know, they had a split, so there's another couple of bakeries that make his particular style of bread here in New York. He became famous generally among, you know, people for his no need to bake bread. Like, there's no necessity to bake bread.
He needs to do that.
Yeah. But no need, which is, you know, my editor, actually, Maria Guarnaschelli, did his book also at Norton, and she's the one that came up with the tagline underneath it, no work, no need, no work bread. So it sold more bread books than anyone's ever sold in the past, because it was like, bread, no work, bread? What? You know what I mean? And so they sold so many of these things. But did he get here? No.
No, we're going to look for him, though.
Oh, so the... Anyway, the point being that he kind of championed this this style, which I don't, you know, I actually don't know where he came up with it, whether it was taught to him or what. If he ever shows up, we'll ask him.
I think he is a self-made man. I think he learned it all myself. Although I'm saying that with no knowledge of the issue whatsoever. I think he's a self-made man.
But you have no actual knowledge of the cooking issue.
None whatsoever.
Yeah. So the the point being is a very influential person in the world of bread. In fact. You know, most people I know – so first of all, there's two things that happened. This no-need thing came at a time when a lot of people, especially pizza people that I – because I don't know as many bread bakers as I knew kind of people who in the kind of pizza world. They, you know, were shifting to extreme long fermentations and retarding of dough when they're making it. Obviously, the longer you let something rise, the less you need to knead, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that – we've all shifted towards this kind of – a lot of people have shifted towards these longer time format breads with less kneading and less work, because the only thing it takes is a little bit of foresight.
So why do they do it? Just for the work issue or for a gastronomic reason
sure? In other words, look, the thing about the no-knead style – and I wish he was, you know, here to like talk about it. He hopefully will be – is the is that if you just let the bread rise for a long time, two things happen. One, the longer – like a short ferment means that you have a lot of yeast in it, right? And so this tends to produce a relatively simple profile of taste, right? Because there's less kind of the yeast is doing less to work on the base product, which is the flour. So the longer you raise, the longer it takes to ferment, usually the more complex the flavor
and
is.
And the more the flour has a chance to express itself.
That's an interesting way. See, this is why Patrick Martins was the founder of Slow Food USA because he comes up with these poetic terms like the flower expressing himself. You know what I mean? It's like, for me, I'm like such a technical head. Like, you know, I don't do the, you know, the poetic. That's why we should come more often. Give you the poetry of the flower.
The slow food. Yeah. Well, we play each other up. Remember our sizzle together? We did good. We played. I'm like the old school guy. You're like the new school guy.
Yeah.
I got a caller if we want to do that while we wait.
Okay. Caller, you're on the air.
Caller, are you there?
You're on the air.
Oh, hey, sorry about that.
Hey.
As a former cook and current restaurant manager, I get a lot of questions about gluten-free and gluten-friendly, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that breaks down under high heat, specifically in pizza ovens or deep fryers. And deep fryers.
You mean how gluten-free coatings work in frying?
Well, so like, if I'm putting items into a deep fryer that are not gluten-free, like how does that gluten that comes off those items break down in the fryer, if at all?
Oh, I gotcha. So you're worried about the fact that you use the same fryer for your regular products as you use for your gluten-free stuff.
Yeah.
You know what? Oh, the bread's here, by the way. You know what? I've never thought about it before. My guess is that it's not a problem because the gluten, while it's not really water soluble, I also don't think it's oil soluble. I think it's just non-soluble. So I don't think you're going to solubilize the gluten in your fat oil. You do get particles. So it all depends on how clear your fat is. But I would guess that your main problem is going to be a straight up contamination. So if you're having straight up contamination problems, but you know, assuming in a commercial frying situation, you're frying in a tube fryer that has a cold zone. And most of that stuff is sifting down to the bottom of your fryer anyway. So I would say, and considering the fact that gluten, even like straight up celiac, oh my God, Jim brought my favorite oil. How the hell did you know that was my favorite oil? What is wrong with you? from DiPaolo's, my favorite place on earth. Oh my goodness.
To conclude, the good news is you never have to wash your fryer.
No. So my point is that most people's responses to gluten is are mediated. In other words, it's like it's not that a tiny amount of gluten is going to wipe them out. But that said, I think that if you're worried about it, it's always prudent to add this kind of thing. Fried in a fryer that also fries items with gluten. And then you're gold. You know what I mean? Like push it back on. In other words, like I wouldn't be worried that you're actually going to hurt somebody, but I would also push it back onto the consumer so that you're not trying to hide anything from them. I think that's always the safest way to go. What do you think? Anyone?
Yeah, it sounds good. I mean, I wasn't too worried about it, but I didn't have a very good answer for people that were going to ask me either.
Yeah,
I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, look, a lot of people have never cooked before, so they don't really understand how it works. They've never fried before. So it's true. When you're frying something that, you know, especially if you do any dry fry stuff that's not a batter, like even a batter, you're throwing stuff off of the batter stuff when it first goes in. But anyone who's ever fried before knows that there's extra pre-dust on the outside, there's extra stuff. It's usually a lot of fried items aren't a straight liquid batter. And even in a straight liquid batter, let's say you're going tempura on it, right? You're getting all those little blebs of crap that fry off. And I don't know anyone on earth who's ever fried anything that hasn't gotten a piece of the last fry occasionally in their life stuck onto the fry that they have now, right? I mean, come on, let's be honest. But the fact of the matter is it's a small amount. I think as long as you're – and if you know you're frying something that is gluten-free, you can be pretty scrupulous about the skim beforehand. And once the stuff is skimmed, all the rest of the stuff falls to the bottom of the cold zone, and you're not going to do the person, I don't think, any harm.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay. Anyone? Anyway, so thanks for that. But now we have to talk about the bread. And if you have any no-need bread questions, we have what? Oh, my God. He comes in. He brings – but now he has to pee. This is – all right. So we'll hold off.
I'll field any more bread questions.
What?
Before we talk, I'll wash my hands.
Okay. He's going to – even though he's not an employee of Roberta's, Jim Lay –
he's still going to wash his hands.
You say he's not going to wash his hands?
He will wash his hands.
He will,
in no urine facility. His bread has no urine in it, which is great.
Okay, so
– no patina of urine.
This happens to be
on the label.
if this is the oil that I'm thinking of.
Why is it your favorite? That's because of the breed of olive, of course.
It's the favorite. So here's what happens. Every year, oil is an agricultural crop, as
so
we all know.
So it goes up and down.
It goes up and down and changes. Yeah. So for a bunch of years, my favorite oil was made by, I forget, the guy's name was starts with a G. Like, he used to make the oil for Fontana Salsa, which was the supplier in Sicily that made this mix of nocciolara. Oh my God, what was the other one? Nocciolara and two other olives that they grow in Sicily. And that was like my favorite oil because I'm heavy on green. I like herby, grassy green with a lot of bite. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Typically, not always, but anyway, whenever I go to buy a new thing of oil, of like finishing oil or eating oil, I'm just like, hey, what do you got that I like? And like, this is one of the ones, I think, if it's the one I'm thinking of, this is...
Where do you shop for your oil? I used to go to Fairway because I always loved Steve Jenkins, but I don't think he does anything with Fairway anymore.
Really?
Pretty sure he doesn't. Yeah, I know he doesn't. Yeah, Fairway has changed.
Fairway,
I mean, did they just
file? Way out.
Yeah, file for bankruptcy. Yeah?
For real?
Yeah.
I thought they were still expanding.
But they're not closing. Somehow it was a restructuring, but they did file for bankruptcy.
That's good. So it's... I buy it at DePaulo's. Listen, if you're ever in New York City, right, and you like Italian products, then you have to go to DePaulo's on Grand Street and Mott. I mean, they've been there for 8 million years. Well, like 90, they moved across the street as far as they went, and.
But I always ask Anne, my wife, who's a cheesemonger, if their European cheeses are the best of their kind. Are they there? Because I mean, some of these old historic places, they don't get the best cheeses that Europe produces.
DePaulo's gets the best of what they get.
Yeah.
In other words, it's like the best. DePaulo's will get the best that is legally available.
Okay.
Like Lou and Sal and Marie, who are the most of the family that runs along with their wives, the kids, and the cousins, and Renee, which is another guy there who works there. They have this thing where they don't like to break the law. And so unlike a lot of other cheese folks, they won't, like, on the sly bring in stuff that's
not legal or
not legit.
Raw milk or, yeah, yeah.
They also, like, will never lie to you. They'll also never sell you a product that's over the hill. So, like, the fact of the matter is – and you know what's coming in today? The DePaulo's. I don't know if I'd known you were going. Do you know the Marcellino's in today?
No, it's not.
Oh, it's not in?
That's what I was going for.
Oh, really?
I wanted the Marcellino.
Oh.
Am I on? I wanted the Marcellino, right? That's what I was going for because I realized that in order to show off this really mediocre example of Tuscan bread. And by mediocre example of Tuscan bread, I mean it's just like you would get in Tuscany.
So mediocre,
and so
yeah.
to understand the bread, you have to understand the cuisine that it functions for, that it lives for. So I think that's my approach. Now, on a scale of 1 to 10... I would rate this for my best Tuscan game, like a 4.
Wait, so what's your best Tuscan game rate?
Like, I would say
what's the most it can get?
I mean, I'm, you know, if I can get a 7 on any loaf of bread, I'm really happy. I'm very contented. An 8 or 9 is you know, sometimes happens. But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, as we all know in the food business, it's all about consistency, right?
Yeah. And as we all know, good cooks, good bakers, all hate themselves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, come on, please!
No, because you never think you're perfect. You never think you've reached anything perfect.
We can always. There's always room for improvement. It's like that last cocktail that you just mixed, that you taste. And you're like, you know, I just could have like put a little bit more vermouth in that. Give me a vermouth drink, David.
Martini.
A martini.
There you go.
Let me ask you, why can't you duplicate a 9 all the time?
Before we get this, two things. One, people want to know, is the character in Trailer Park Boys named after you?
Wait, I'm going to do one thing real quick. I like this.
That's the bread being sliced. And two, don't go through your knee.
Yeah,
oh, my God.
That would be the third time that's ever happened in the studio.
So the, oh, my God. You know what? Do you remember, like, in college when those people who'd never sliced bagels before started slicing bagels and they would slice the bagel into their hand and bleed all over everything?
Jesus.
Yeah. Awesome times.
And listen, I learned to have incredible respect for meat slicers at the age of 15 because I cut my fingertip off.
Oh yeah.
Me too.
The only real damage I've done, I did a thumb into the meat slicer once.
Me too.
Yeah.
Slide down, boom.
It's because I was on the cell phone, though. It was my fault.
And never use a knife that's dull.
That's the worst.
To try to take out an avocado pit.
Oh, would you glance off?
No, I cut my thumb wide open.
Ah, jeez.
Because the knife didn't go, the blade didn't hit the seed.
Right.
Bounced off and then took a chunk of my head off.
Okay, so let me set this up real quick. So we're at the Museum of Food and Drinks Benefit.
MOFAD.
And Patrick and Jim are at the same table, and they were arguing over who was the straight man in the team. And that, which is kind of like an interesting thing. And I said, hey, I love your bread, obviously, have for a long time. Don't you think Tuscan bread sucks? And expecting a yes, because everyone thinks it sucks because it contains no salt.
If it's from Tuscany, it sucks.
Yeah. It's like nobody, I said nobody likes Tuscan bread. Tuscans don't like Tuscan bread.
The epicenter of where dining at tables began, ground zero, as far as food historians know, of where the ritualized meal of everyone sitting around a table was born.
Also, and the Italian language itself was born out of Tuscany. Yeah, a lot came out of that place.
I forgot. E tu capisci tante cose. Figurati. E parliamoci un po' di italiano.
So you guys can't see what I'm looking at, but this looks like a Tuscan loaf, i.e. the crust looks terrible, and the crumb is not nearly as nice as the normal crumb in the Sullivan Street breads.
You have to qualify your language. At the end of the day, beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, it's okay, let me put it this way. I won't say anything. It is sallow and dry looking,
but it's design.
Like a mop. It like it sucks sauce up. It's also duty.
Consider it this. I mean, this did not ferment. This is an organic wheat from a small mill in Minneapolis called Sunrise Flour Mill, and I'm not used to working with it. It's not like my. I don't work with this flour. I was sent a sample of some wheat for MOFAD. Which it went into those loaves that we made for the event, but
which were delicious.
Why
I missed my mark by about 20 minutes to a half an hour in terms of ideal fermentation, which would have made a real big difference in terms of what you see in terms of the crumb structure. However, that being said, when you eat bread in Tuscany and if it's made from local grain, and this is also an argument about the aesthetics of bread and our expectations about bread, especially bread made in a local original grain economy, where the quality of the wheats are not going to be consistent from season to season. And oftentimes, especially with weather like we have today, when it occurs in like August or September during harvest season, harvest periods, will most likely lead to wheat that has a lesser quality protein in terms of its ability to ferment, because when there's humidity, you end up on dry wheat stalks, you oftentimes end up with like incidental germination. And that germination destroys the quality. It doesn't cut into the percentage of protein in the flour and isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's natural. It's what really occurs when you really farm and you're not spraying glyphosate in your crops 2 weeks before harvesting to kind of make them more sellable, you know?
Which so is kind charmingly of, inconsistent, you would say.
Well, I mean, that's what we'd have to get used to.
Well, do you ever bake with germinator sprouted grains?
Sometimes for like, you know, for my own head, man, you know?
Now,
like,
am I allowed to just taste this as is? Or
yeah, I mean, we
can
taste it as is.
Do I need a spiel to make it taste good?
No spiel. I don't want to like, oh, this is grown in, like, you know, some, like, farm upstate New York in the Champlain River Valley and da-da-da, whatever. I mean, I could go off on this whole fucking story, but at the end of the day, it's
family show.
I'm sorry, is it? No more cursing.
Yeah, it's family show.
Is it?
I have a caller on the line for Jim, actually.
Okay, I'm in the wrong place.
We have a caller on the air, but before the caller gets on, let me just... I'll give you the taste description.
Do I need to put this?
Yeah, put it on. Put it on so you can hear. It's more fermented than most Tuscan loaves I've had. I.e., it's got a higher turn. Can you turn the headphones up on Jim's? I think
it. Turn it down.
Oh, turn it down. It's more. It's got more acidity than most of the Tuscan loaves that I've had. And true to form, it tastes like it needs some freaking salt in it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I was just calculating. There's about 1/3 of 1% of salt. So it isn't even a percent of salt, but based on the batch, maybe even a 1/10 of a percent of salt in the dough.
And what's your normal salt percentage?
Breads in general that we're used to eating, anywhere from 1.5% to 2.5% sometimes.
Are you part of that more modern 2.5%?
I'm more a percent and a half. I'm not a 1%er, but I'm more in the 1.5%. I like to taste the grain.
And were you a 1%er? Would you be a Wall Street 1%er or a motorcycle gang 1%er?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. It's really not the 1%. It's the 1/10. I'm gonna sound like Bernie Sanders now. It's the 1/10 of the 1% that control 48% of the wealth of our nation. And you didn't realize you're gonna have Bernie Sanders impersonator.
That's good. That's good. Can you also do the aardvark? Can you also do the aardvark from the Ant and the Aardvark cartoon?
There's a caller.
I don't want to miss a caller. You're on the air for Jim.
Hi, Jim and Dave. This is Jeffrey in Costa Mesa.
Dude,
how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. So I've been baking a lot of bread and both kind of straight Levon style, or whatever term you like to use, and then also hybrid, using, you know, incorporating some commercial yeast. And I've specifically been interested in trying to manipulate how the starter, the ferment, is fed, held, what hydration it's kept at, because there are a lot of claims out there, let's say, about how that will affect structure, flavor, complexity. And so I traveled down this
path. Yeah, I was going to say
that again.
Viscosity is there's no like fixed thing on viscosity. As I was saying before, with regional wheats, if you want to control the outward appearance of the product, and your wheat, for example, varies in protein percent or quality, which can in turn change the absorption. One of the factors that can change and alter the absorption, which therefore affects the viscoelasticity of the dough, i.e. its texture, when a very precise amount of liquid has been added to it, I would be more concerned as a bread baker or craft baker with the apparent viscoelasticity of the dough than getting caught up with, well, I put exactly, you know, 85% hydration, because you might get a great bread out of 75% hydration if the wheat is of a different quality. And I think that, you know, and in terms of how you hold a sourdough starter, the thicker and drier the pre-ferment, the more gradual and slower the rate of fermentation. The more water, the faster it will ferment.
So
wetter things ferment
quick. I tried to start testing variables specifically with that and realized, like doing side by side, and realized it would just take an eternity to actually nail down the way all of these could potentially affect each other.
Oh,
so I'm wondering if you can speak to specifically how feeding, holding, and the hydration level or the viscosity, like you're saying, of the actual pre-ferment, and how that's how can that affect the specifically the balance of lactic acid.
Let's go this way. If you go online, you can buy these really cool pH meters that you can attach to your iPhone, and you can upload an app.
Do those work?
They do. If they're calibrated, my assistant's shaking his head like no fucking way. You can also buy there are pH meters that you can use to test the pH of the dough. You will find a correlation between in a finished dough. You'll find a range or correlation between the pH of the dough, because, you know, what happens, you mix the dough together, and the pH will initially dip a little bit, like within the first 15 to 20 minutes, and then it will go up. It will arc upward, like say 6%, like 6 pH. And then eventually over...
You're talking about during the fermentation or during the baking?
Yeah, all those. Whenever you add flour and water together and you allow, and you have some agent, fermenting agent, be it commercial yeast, or if I was like Bernie Sanders, if you want a fermentation agent... I'm sorry. I've been on this whole Bernie Sanders kick lately. You know that he's the only electable... I know, I'm getting even more head shakes for my... He's the only...
Not a political show.
Oh, shit. Okay. because the shit won't, negative ads won't stick with him, but they're going to stick with Hillary. But we'll go back to fermentation. So if you measure the pH, you'll see that there's a really precise correlation between the pH of the dough, the length of time it takes for the dough to leaven, for example, under whatever constant conditions, mm-hmm. i.e. if your house temperature, room temperature, whatever it is, or you use your home oven with the pilot light on as like an incubator.
Right.
I don't know to what degree you're of a bread geek you are, but you sound like pretty much a bread nerd severe because you're obsessed, which is good. So we're all there. And then you'll see like an end result. You'll see a correlation between the pH and the flavor profile. You'll see a correlation between the pH and the effect that the acidity has on the dough's ability to, the yeasts that exist within the dough's ability to leaven the bread. Okay. Because at certain pHs, yeasts become inactive, i.e. In the lab, they say 4.4. But in like practically, it's like more like 4. When you're at like 4.6, at least in New York City bread baking, if you're doing sourdough, you're pretty much, you know, dealing with bread that's pretty sour. There's also another factor, which is the tap water, because tap water varies from pH 6.6 in environments that are extremely acidic, and tap water in municipalities can go, I think, as high as 8. But you know, I know
how buffered are those though? Won't the actual biological system of the bread take over the tap water pretty quickly, or no?
Well, I mean, you have to factor in the pH of the flour, the pH of the water, and then the rate of the effect of the ferments on the dough. But at least everything that I've read is that when the pH is 4.4. That fermentation stops, even if there is available glucose or materials to ferment. It's just the acidity itself, which is why a lot of people who maintain and hold starters at too high of a temperature and create these acid cultures are like, I don't know why I keep adding the starter to the dough, but it like just doesn't do anything. It just kind of gets all kind of slack, and they make the bread, and it tastes really tart. And it's because what's going on is there's no fungal, it's just bacterial. It's like a flora. You know, you have to maintain the right flora for the starter. And in terms of, to answer your question in a circumlocutious way, peripatetic mm-hmm. way,
sure.
It's really just about, you know, yeasts and microbes are constantly mutating. And they will adapt and become tolerant to conditions that you establish. The ones that we like, the ones that make bread and wine taste good, are the ones that are kind of in the 55 to 68 degree range. And then once you start getting above 68 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to start noticing other types of microbes. It's not to say that you can't maintain a starter for a couple weeks at 75 degrees Fahrenheit, but eventually it's going to acidify. And that balance between the symbiotic relationship between those classes of Saccharomyces and those classes of Lactobacilli will change.
Okay.
Is that cool?
Do you find it to be a kind of a one-to-one balance of if the yeast is more active, the lactobacilli are less active, and vice versa?
Well, I mean, there's the other thing is that, you know, it's, you know, when it's feeding time at the zoo, you know, a starter with a lower pH that's younger, it will react differently with the finished dough. And even that ratio or proportion of pre-ferment to the finished dough, you know, if I had, like, a half, 500 grams. We're going to talk metric, right?
Oh, yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
So, like, let's say I had 500 grams of flour, and I added 500 grams of like pre-ferment, levain, liquid, a stiff kind of mm-hmm. dough, like what I call biga, mm-hmm. and the pH of that dough was like 4.5, 4.3, whatever. Hopefully not 3.6. 7 or lower, because then it's so acid that the actual pH of the dough, there's a very, the window would be too small. So, but if you add like a large ratio of pre-ferment to finished dough, you could even add like 300 grams of flour if the pH of the pre-ferment is on the higher side, like 4.6 and up. You could make a dough where there's actually the largest component would be the pre-ferment, and then you're just adding a little bit of flour and salt to kind of put it together, and your mm-hmm. your fermentation time would be reduced to like an hour and a half, say.
Okay.
Or like a la no need or a la the methods that I prescribe, mostly for practical purposes, maybe not so practical after all. But if you use a small percentage, let's say that that curve, that window of fermentation is a lot longer, and there's more chances of manipulating it or coaxing it to get the right end result that you want.
Wait, but Jim, to go back to what you were saying, and I mean to cut into this, but the lower the amount of starter that you're pitching in, right, the less the initial actual acidity matters, but still the balance of flora in the starter is going to be different if you start with a really acid. In other words, like
if you put like an acid, if you put a highly acidic starter in a dough that was being maintained at like 75 degrees and was like just basically a bacterial starter, it's not designed. It's not. It won't function to leaven the bread. It will function to cause the flour to become. The paste, the dough, the pasta, to become acidic. And that's all it's going to do. I mean, I've seen bakers in Italy that that keep their natural leavening in their bake shop at like, you know, like 100 degrees all the time, and it's like just inedible acidic crap.
By the way, Jim hates Italian bread in general, right?
No, I love. No, that's not true. I love Italian. I love it.
Didn't you go to Italy and tell them that they're all garbage?
No, I went there and I told them that that they have a crisis.
Carlo Petrini said the same thing. He said the biggest free fall in terms of Italian quality products with either the fast food culture we live in or modernization is with bread. Mm-hmm. He said they're in a crisis. He said that in 1998, 2000 already.
Well, I said it last year. I'm sorry, I'm eating some Tuscan bread with some broccoli rabe.
He also said the same about cheese. And although he was very much responsible for getting Barolo and Barbaresco up, I mean, literally one vineyard trip at a time, he was like, you should age the grapes longer, you should do all these things, cut off the bad grapes and not use them in the wine. I mean, Barolo and Barbaresco were pretty mediocre wines in the 70s, 80s. So yeah, Carlo was saying it about...
I've had some Barolo from that era that was freaking delicious.
Well, Nebbiolo grape, that whole region of Barbaresco and stuff, yeah, some could be delicious, of course, but...
Oh, by the way, the meat that you brought here is really barnyardy, huh? Patrick loves
amazing.
It. Patrick loves some barnyard in his meat.
This is amazing. This is obviously from DePaolo's, because I can always tell when something's made in Europe with my wife's cheeses. I'm like, this is a great American
it's
cheese.
It's domestic.
Like, it's French. This is domestic? I'm very surprised.
It's very excellent. Surprised. Well, I mean, I'm not anymore. I mean, I was going to bring you some of my piggy.
Mm-hmm.
What,
you bought a whole pig or something?
No, I raised... three pigs last. I've been doing it for the last 3 years.
What breed?
Tamworth.
Oh, wow.
Oh, you like Tam? Well, Tams are good mothers, right? So they're easy. They're easier to raise because they won't, like, squash their kids and, like, they can feed themselves.
My neighbors and I usually get, like, 5 piglets. I take 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the summertime, because I have a house upstate in Sullivan County, I like, anytime we're cooking, every day, usually at the end of the day, I just head over to the I don't want to call it a pigsty because they have like a little bit of a yard, but then they've got like 2 acres of woods to forage in. So the animals, you know, go the summer eating vegetable scraps and whatever critters they find as they're rooting up the earth.
It's a great bacon hog, the Tamworth.
Yeah, yeah. It's a phenomenal meat.
They don't muscle up though, right?
Yeah, they're a leaner hog.
It's very rare that I actually buy, I buy pork from... I mean, I only eat my own.
Well, that'll explain why we haven't gotten any orders from you in the past 4 months.
Right, right, right. Sorry about that.
Listen, before this is over, we should talk about the Tuscan bread. Now, listen, I want you to sell me...
Now, do you see what I'm saying about the Tuscan bread's function? is really
a blank canvas.
A blank canvas for the food.
I'm not buying it. Here's the thing.
Canvas.
But you can't eat this. Right, you can't eat the pecorino, and you can't eat the oil without wishing instead that we were eating your like semidecessimo.
Well, there's a
I'm like, oh, you know what I wish? I wish I just had the semidecessimo.
I wish I wasn't in Tuscany.
Or however you pronounce it.
It's funny.
I was in Chelsea.
For me, there's the act
or a Pugliese or any one of your
breads. For me, this is very nostalgic, and I actually kind of, in some ways, like my favorite breakfast is Tuscan bread, saltless butter. And honey.
Is that like saying that I also like Twinkies?
That's even more
Maybe.
Cruel.
That's more
saltless butter, too.
Is there any way I can get a beer?
I think
that beer that you're drinking looks really good.
Sure, I need some salt.
Because I keep eating all this salty food.
We're a full-service establishment.
Okay.
But we have a
PhD here in anthropology and sociology, Kostas Gounis, who's flown in all the way from Crete to share with us his insights and thoughts about this discussion.
So give us some thoughts on the discussion from a Cretan perspective.
I won't get into it.
No?
It's not my field.
Let me ask you this.
I'm enjoying it.
This is your chance to bash Italy.
Let me ask you this. The bread in Crete, they put salt in it, do they not?
Yes, they do.
What do you think of this you know how good Jim's bread is.
Right.
What do you think of this?
Interesting. I mean, bland.
Diplomatic.
Bland.
Bland. Mm. Also, the crust doesn't have the same... It doesn't have
it's
the texture
not alive.
That it should have.
Yeah. It's like mushy or stretchy.
It's dry.
Dry.
The way Tuscan bread is baked, it's baked with no salt or a little or no salt. It's baked... Usually, initially, every bakery that does it the traditional way tries to maintain a dry oven for the first 3 to 7 minutes of the bake, whereby the dough, in this case, because the dough was under-fermented, it kind of rounds out a little bit, lifts off the floor of the oven, forms a crust or skin on the dough, the opposite of what you would think.
Right.
Like you're not looking for humidity. And then...
But how do they do that? Do they use a low load in the oven?
They either open up the damper and the door at loading in, or, you know, the whole... And then it's baked at between 380 and 400 degrees, depending upon the bakery, for a lot longer than you would normally bake. So you end up with this loaf of bread that actually is kind of semi-stale in a way.
Right.
To begin with, but it doesn't really stale. Like, I can eat this bread in 3 days, and it's textually not that different than it is today.
It's like,
it starts off as 2-day-old, but it stays there.
Yeah, but it doesn't, you know, but the idea, what is staleness? Staleness is a perceptual thing.
It's an elasticity of the crust?
Well, no, it's, I mean, yes, you
chewier.
Could say that.
But well, there's technical explanations, and then there's when you eat it, does it taste like garbage?
Well,
right?
that's subjective when you right. say that something tastes like garbage. It's all relative. I mean, for me,
Oscar the Grouch loves garbage.
I'm not saying this is garbage. That's
I mean, like,
saying.
One of my favorite snacks would be, like, this bread. Like, I didn't bring, I was going to bring some garlic in a toaster oven, but I couldn't bring all that stuff with me. But just to do fitunta, you know, just to do the bread, toasted,
right.
rubbed with garlic, a little bit of olive oil. I go one step further. I like to put vinegar on my bread because I just like vinegar.
So you're saying this is actually baked longer, even though the crust color is a lot lower than what it would normally be because of the...
My daughter doesn't like it when I talk with food in my mouth, but I'm going to go for it.
2-minute warning, Dave.
All right, yeah, come on.
Oh, shit. The bread is baked at a lower temperature, which is why the color of the bread is the way it is.
Right, right.
If there was a higher quantity of salt, or any percentage of salt over 1%, you would end up with the scarring that takes, I call it salt scarring, where the little alveoli that are along the surface of the dough would kind of become places where the salt will crystallize. So you end up having like, you end up seeing, you ever seen like bread that's kind of like pale and white, but it's like overcooked.
Yes,
that's like my name for it is salt scarring, and you see like the little white dots. Like if you see dough that's slow fermented or fermented in refrigerators, which is very popular these days.
Oh, you don't like refrigeration retarding?
I think it's a little retarded. Ha ha ha. No, I guess
someone doesn't do it every day and they realize it's rising too fast, they need to slow it down a little bit.
It's really convenient that we have refrigeration. It's lovely that we have it.
I'm a big supporter.
I'm a big yes. You're in the meat biz.
I mean, you wouldn't say like throw it in the fridge and the next time pitch less in or what?
Well, I mean, you know, as a thing of convenience, yeah, we have refrigeration. But in general, I like live baking. I like the element of risk. I like that I have to kind of be kind of connected to the process of the fermentation, so that I can control it without necessarily having to employ a battery of refrigerators and increase my carbon footprint.
Right. Can I ask one last question? Because it was so interesting to HRNN News. Did you say, I'm just wanting to make a quote, if it's possible, that climate change and El Nino and global warming could perhaps be negatively affecting the quality of artisan bread around the world? Is there a direct correlation? Did I hear you kind of hinted that?
No,
way, because it's too dry.
El Nino still makes me think of Chris Farley.
I am El Nino. No, of course. But I thought you said weather affects the bread. It could lower the quality of local granaries' ingredients.
There's a reason why during our colonial period. Excuse me one second. Oh, fucking broccoli, Rob.
One minute, Dave.
Ew.
All right. During our colonial period, wheat was grown everywhere. Brooklyn was like the epicenter of wheat agriculture in at least in this state.
Yeah, and one of the great apples in the world came out of there, but now
Spitzenberg?
Spitzenberg, yeah. So right now, you know, we can grow wheat here. It's just that our expectation about what good bread is, it's like you can't fit square pegs into round holes without kind of losing a little bit of the squareness, a little bit of the roundness of each. And so I think that our idea about what good bread is needs to change. Like, we're still kind of stuck in this dialogue of, like, does it have big holes and stuff? And, like, does it, you know.
You know what we didn't get to? It's pissing me off. Everyone wants to know, where do they go after the no-knead technique so that they can use your technique but build up to make different styles of bread? And we're not going to have time to get into it.
I have a new book coming out, and it has a whole thing on using natural leavening for no-knead. I'm doing it with.
When's it coming out?
God knows. I'm doing it with Maria.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So look out for that. Secondly,
but you know it will come out. I know that we're like at the final phases of retesting recipes, and hopefully by next year.
Do you believe in labeling?
Huh?
Do you like to label things in the kitchen?
I personally love labeling.
Okay.
I just
here. Take this. This is a limited edition, thank you, Cooking Issues blue tape keychain.
Oh, it's so cute. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on Cooking. Wait, on the way out, as they're playing the theme, what is the most alarming piece of garbage in the bread world today? What's the worst thing
besides
that's happening in bread?
Tuscan bread? Besides
By the way, Jim has taught us it's not bad, it's different. It's not different. It's different. Love things for what they are.
I like homework.
What is Martin's potato rolls?
Oh!
They do taste good, but I mean, I'm not like a. I just think bad bread is bad bread. I mean,
gosh,
fast food is fast food. I'm sorry, I don't care what corporation is behind it.
Wow, Cooking Issues.
I know.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.